Hello and welcome to the Metal Hammer podcast, episode 139. I'm Elle and I'm here with our reviews editor, Jonathan Seltzer. How are you doing?
Feeling anxious, a little bit sleep deprived after watching some of the action sort of semi-results last night. But I have coffee. It's not happening anxiety, but it's happening sleep deprivation. So, you know, I'm somewhere in between.
Well done with your coffee. And I'm also here with Stephen Hill, our lovely Metal Hammer writer. How are you, Stephen?
I'm all right, thanks. I've had plenty of sleep because I'm luckily for me, I have absolutely no empathy at all. So I don't really care about what's going on in the world. So I noticed that there was an election, but I just went to bed and slept soundly like a baby.
You're an empathy vacuum, you're saying.
Yeah. I'm just, you know, it's lucky that I just don't care about anyone else, I suppose. Just, you know, good for me.
Well, very interesting, very nihilistic.
Wards off emotional vampires, at least.
Of course, the election is a big deal right now. Depending on when you're listening to this, we may or may not know the outcome and what is going on in America. But if you need a distraction from that, of course, you have this podcast. And our current issue is also on shelves, featuring Judas Priest on the cover. We're celebrating 50 years of Judas Priest and 50 years of heavy metal. We also have in the issue interviews with Backwash, Ghostmane, Mr. Bungle, Amaranth, Venom Prison, Greg Pujato, Devil Driver, Paul Bearer, loads of people, really. So go and pick that up. Apart from the election, what actually has been happening?
Quite a lot of things. I did like double live stream fun on Saturday.
I think we've all done live streams this weekend. Do you want to? Should we start with Code Orange? Because we both watched that. That was on Saturday, wasn't it? Live stream.
Yeah.
So this is kind of following on for anyone who doesn't know the background. Code Orange were basically the first out the gate, weren't they, really, with the live streams. They're meant to be promoting their new album and they couldn't do, so they got massive room and did a show in that. And now they've come back to do another gig with three supports. How did you find it, Steve?
Well, I mean, I've been on record as to how much I love Code Orange for some time now, so this will shock nobody, but I thought it was amazing. I really liked Jesus Piece's support set was great as well. They had Jesus Piece, Year of the Knife, and
Machine Girl.
I nearly said Lady Baby then, but that's a completely different thing.
That's a completely different thing.
Yeah, it is. And I thought the first two were pretty good, and I thought Jesus Piece were great. But Code Orange, I think Code Orange have described themselves as the innovators of live streaming rather than because I know obviously Trivium, one band, for example, who were doing it before Code Orange did it. But I don't think I've seen another band do. They've done like three streams and they've done a bunch of stuff on Instagram, whatever. And just nobody's, again, much like their record and their music, I think no one's really doing what they're doing. Like each one has their very unique own individual feel to it. Like the last one they did, the Under the Skin was like a kind of MTV Unplugged acoustic style set, which I thought was an incredibly brave thing for a hardcore band to do. And this one was just some kind of audio visual sensory overload of a show. It was fucking brilliant. And I'm really glad we're getting to see lots of live Code Orange because I'm gutted that they've not been able to tour that record. And I mean, we'll probably get into the little minutia of it, but overall as a show, I thought it was amazing. Absolutely amazing.
I felt like I was trapped in some kind of dystopian future world. Though maybe I shouldn't say dystopian because that implies
you probably are.
It's bad. I mean, we are, let's face it, because it was just literally like being inside a box with like six people just doing mad things to your eyeballs, wasn't it? It was called Back Inside the Glass, and they had all these insane projections. Even the cameraman was wearing white so that they could project onto him, and they had these insane projections with all different colors for different songs. They had costume changes. There was one bit where Jamie was wearing a long black trench coat and he went and knelt on one of the kind of podiums they had in the exact pose of Brandon in The Crow, And it was literally, I took a photo of it, it was literally like mimicking the crow. So on the one hand, it's this kind of uncontrolled chaos. You know, he hit his head on the floor, didn't he? And just bled. Mm. And on the other hand, it's very carefully stage managed. It's a really interesting balance, what they're doing, I think.
Yeah, I think it's really cool to see a band who have that, I think what metal used to have, which is that, like, it's very real, and it feels very dangerous, and it feels very spontaneous, but at the same time, they're larger than life characters. You know, they've got that kind of modern hip hop swagger about them, and they're kind of their reference points for, you know, like you mentioned the Crow. They did a Pantera cover, they covered A New Level as well, they did a bit of the riff from A New Level, and I don't know, like, I mean, it's more stuff from what I've already said about Code Orange. I just feel like I've waited so long to see a band who do the same thing as what sort of Slipknot did in the sort of latter part of the 90s, who just come along and sound really fresh and really heavy and really creative. And I don't know. I mean, I just don't know what you want. If you're not excited by Code Orange, I kind of think, well, I don't know what you want from heavy music, because they sort of nail everything. But they literally nailed the whole, everything they've done in the last year has been stellar.
I think I've said this before, you might feel like you've seen it before, like you might feel like you saw it in the 90s, but you're a 90s guy and you still like it. It, like, there's lots of kind of homage type stuff going on. But what I thought they did really well, that not everybody has got right in a live stream, is the feeling of movement. It felt like when they had cuts and when they had changes and when they had lights and things, it felt like everything was moving and you didn't know what's happening. Whereas some live streams I've seen, it's literally been a band standing there. And if you're not there in the room, you don't get that like kinetic feeling. So that was cool.
Yeah. And they did, they use kind of cuts, the way that it cut from camera to camera and angles. And there was points where you'd see all four of them, like it would do, you'd do like split screen stuff, which I know might sound a bit like, you know, 1980s Top of the Pops or whatever, but like it was really, really effective, so that you could see exactly what everybody was doing. And, you know, talking about like it, I think homage is absolutely the right word. Like, their Code Orange don't hide their metal influences in the sort of time period from what they've been influenced by, but it's all the stuff that those bands never got a chance to do, which I find really, really exciting about them. I mean, like I say, the kind of the modern hip hop influence and the influence of kind of, I guess, more ambient electronic stuff and all of that, which you didn't really get from metal back in the day, and you're starting to get it from Code Orange. And they don't look like a timepiece to me. They look like a completely cutting edge current band. And that was as modern looking and contemporary looking as any kind of live stream that I've seen from any band, whatever the budget.
Well, let's throw it to Jonathan now, because Jonathan must have had quite a different experience at Obituary.
Yeah. So it wasn't actually this weekend, it was the weekend before that, but they've been doing a series of three live streams. So they did a rarities one this evening, which unfortunately I was otherwise engaged, so I couldn't watch it. But I saw the Cause of Death one, which was weekend before that. And the weekend before that, they did the debut album, Sally We Rot. And it was like the completely opposite experience of you, in a way. Like, it's not the most contemporary thing in the world, but it's one of the absolute foundation stones of the extreme metal world. And I've got a really personal relationship with that record, because it was one of the first death metal records I ever really got. And I saw Obituary on the Cause of Death tour in 1990 at the Dome in London, when I was just kind of getting into the whole kind of death metal scene. So it's not kind of contemporary, but the way they play it now, I mean, they're such stunning musicians now, that I don't know, the sense of time just is absolutely meaningless. You're just in the moment when they play it, as you always are whenever you hear that record. But, you know, it's kind of much more doomy sounding, but it's really catchy. The stream got put back by half an hour, because they started playing and you couldn't hear anything. It was just, the sound was completely clipped. So there's all these people on the chat by the side of it going, what the fuck's going on? But that was kind of almost worth it for the pause of death comments. But yeah, it's just it reminds me of a time in the sort of like the death metal world where, like, you know, the excitement we had then is the excitement that you're having now.
Yeah,
there's a new genre and every band is doing something very different with it, and you know, something that's very unique to them, whether it was, you know, them or Death or, you know, all the other bands from that Dare side or all the bands you could tell immediately. I mean, and I find it hard now with modern death metal bands to go, ah, you hear a riff from a modern death metal band, go, that riff belongs to them. But you hear Bitchery or you hear Dare side, and you can tell straight away which riff is riff. I mean, which riff is whose, you know. They all have their really unique sound. And so it's kind of part nostalgia, it's part living in the moment. And, you know, there wasn't too much like flashy stuff that had lights going on. There was on a soundstage, had the Bitchery logo, different camera angles. But everyone was just like, when it finally started, everyone was just like in just like the zone. You could tell by the comments as well, and just in their total happy place. And all these songs are so classic. And they're so just like, you know, in your bones, you hear Body Bag or Chopped in Half. And yeah, just that groove that they've got. And also, you know, I love his vocals. I love the fact that sometimes he wasn't even singing vocals, he was just making sounds.
I was going to say.
Yeah. And at the time as well, you know, when I got the Cause of Death album, I was looking at the lyrics and the theme seemed to be like undergoing death as a psychedelic experience. And I really like that.
That's such a Jonathan thing to say, undergoing death as a psychedelic experience.
Yeah.
That sounds like a pretty amazing show. You saw vocals as well, didn't you, Steve?
Yeah.
Sorry, Jonathan. Talking about your excitement.
I watched the Bungle stream as well, which was an hour before Code Orange, so I kind of watched them back to back. It was a bit like, it's the closest thing to being at a festival that I've had this year, because I was like, I had both live streams up and the sort of countdown to Code Orange one happening as I was watching Bungle. So that was cool. It was really, really funny, the Mr. Bungle stream. Like, I mean, we kind of mentioned the new album. Is it a new album? Well, we mentioned the latest release last week and how good it is. It is, you know, a bunch of recordings from 1986, like a kind of updated songs from 1986. So they are thrash metal songs. You've got Scott Ian and Dave Lombardo playing in the band these days. But it was kind of in like a library. And when they started, and Patton was dressed in a kind of a red cardigan, and they all sat there reading a book. And it was just quiet, and then there was this kind of tinkly tonkly music played, and they started with a cover of the Mr. Rogers theme tune. You know, Mr. Rogers, won't you be my neighbor? That guy, the American.
I actually don't know it. I've heard of Mr. Rogers, but I've never actually.
Yeah, guy with a horse, right?
You what? Sorry,
the guy with a horse, right? No,
has he got a horse?
I thought that was Mr. Ed or something.
Yeah,
Mr. Ed. Yeah. No, Mr. Rogers is Tom Hanks just played him in a film. It's a really good film. But he's a very like nice man, so he didn't really. And they did this kind of cover, which they slightly bungled up. They did it sort of as Faith No More tend to do, and Mike Patton's projects tend to do. Like, it was quite straight, but there was a couple of occasions where they'd sort of thrash it up a little tiny bit. So that was cool. And then they went into, you know, the majority of songs they played were songs from the Raging Wrath of the Easter Bunny demo, but they also played Summer Breeze as covered by. And in between songs, they had, because obviously there's no audience there, it would cut to this chair and there'd be one person sat in a chair who would react to it. So King Buzzo from the Melvins was there, Josh Homme from Queens of Stone Age was there, Henry Rollins was there, that one of the guys from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia was there as well. And they were kind of talking to the audience. At the end, they got up and they to do like an encore. And they were like, scream if you want an encore. And obviously there's no one there. So they just didn't do an encore because they didn't. So it was really funny. And, you know, all that material, I think, is like I sort of mentioned last week. It's a really good thrash metal record. But with the addition of Mike Patton and Mike Patton's unique vocals, that kind of takes a good thrash metal record to probably the best thrash metal record for about 5 years, I would say.
It's I was really impressed by that record. And if you don't know, it's got Scott Ian and Dave Lombardo on it. So it's got thrash royalty all over it, bringing that back to the, obviously, a refreshed version of their first demo. Awesome. I saw Pussifer as well. That was on Friday night. Honestly, there were so many streams this weekend. And that was amazing. I was really excited about it because it was at this place called Arcasanti in Arizona. And Arcasanti was this really weird project by this architect called Paolo Soleri. And he began construction on this town in 1970. And it was really futuristic. It was like a vision of the future with like concrete amphitheater and like weird concrete housing that was all on top of each other. And their new record, which we talked about last week, Pussifer's Existential Reckoning, is kind of quite futuristic and cold sounding and kind of weird and spacey. They've got like a old Fairlight synthesizer on it. So the setting was really cool because you knew it was going to be something that felt really different. And they had several setups. They had one in the amphitheater and they had one that looked like it was kind of under a big concrete arch thing. And they had another one that was just out in the desert. And it was super cool. They were kind of dressed up like their characters, like they're pretending to be special agents on this record. And often it was Maynard with co-vocalist Karina Round on this kind of scaffolding platform singing to each other, which kind of brought a bit more warmth, I think, to some of the kind of colder sounding songs. And the set list was all the new stuff. And it was just a production. Like, I've not seen a live stream like this that's literally a big live show recorded like it would be for a DVD. I've not seen it done the same way. And it was produced by Danny Wimmer, who produces a lot of the big US festivals. So there's obviously a lot of clout and money behind that. And they'd really put like so much time and effort into staging it. And they've extended it actually until Sunday, the 8th of November. So if you haven't seen it, you can still catch that. And it's definitely worth watching, especially towards the end, to see the sunset over the kind of mountainous desert area while they're singing. It's super cool. You know, they've just taken something, you know, the concept of streaming and just thrown all the creativity and resource at it, and it looks great. So yeah, a good weekend of streaming, I think.
Yeah, there's loads of awesome. Jested were playing, Moonspell was supposed to play, but I think both them and Cradle of Filth have had to put their streaming dates back.
So, yeah,
it's all going on, just Halloween stuff. Devin Townsend did a rarity set as well last Saturday. So, yeah, you're a sport for choice.
Loads of stuff going on. This is a good time. It might be a bit of a shit time in the outside world, but it's a good time for streaming and it's a good time for bands. So, I mean, I just kind of threw this in for news. The election's happening. I saw that Trent Reznor had kind of come out in support of Biden, and I've seen a few other musicians comment. I don't know, have you guys seen anything around the internet? There's people kind of talking about the election, but...
Yeah, I can't believe Nine Inch Nails has suddenly gone all political. Like, Nine Inch Nails, Springsteen, Dave Morello suddenly found this newfound interest in politics. Bob Dylan and bloody Woody Guthrie will be doing it next.
Yeah, Matt, such opportunists, right?
We were talking last week, should bands be political? And it seems like quite a lot of bands are kind of being political at the moment. And we had Amy Lee being political a few months back with her video about registering to vote. So it'll be interesting to see what happens after this and kind of which bands are speaking out and if there's any new music or anything off the back of that.
I think just takes on a weird tangent. Like, so much metal is inherently political anyway, whether it's not explicitly. I think thrash was political because back in the day, even wasn't anything explicitly political, but was definitely a reaction to, like, you know, the Cold War and the fear of nuclear war and everything. So
yeah, I always find it interesting to hear you talk about that because you were actually kind of around at the time.
Yeah, so I might have said this on the podcast before, but I had this epiphany a while back, like, because I remember like the fear of nuclear war in the 80s, and you know, when you had those movies like The Day After Tomorrow. And I'm trying to remember what the British one was, but scared the shit out of everybody in the this post-nuclear drama on BBC. That just scared the shit out of everyone. So I remember every loud noise I heard, I thought was a siren going off because I'm about 8 years old and I'm you know, or 12 or something, and I'm massively paranoid like everyone else. And so you're constantly tensing, like going, what the fuck is that? Is that the end of the world? And the thrash riffs, those kind of taut, choppy riffs, they're the physical analog of you constantly tensing up, bracing for the end. And thrash is so linked to, you know, the threat of nuclear war that it's actually a genuine physical response that that the way I was kind of tensing up constantly is exactly the same as how thrash riffs are played.
Yeah, I always find that super interesting, and it definitely makes me look at things in a different light. In other news, the Chris Fenn versus Slipknot legal case has been settled. Ex-Slipknot percussionist Chris Fenn's lawsuit against the band was voluntarily discontinued on October 29th with prejudice. So I think that means basically he can't ever refile that case. It should be sorted out now. So whatever has happened behind closed doors, and that's now a chapter that can be over. But I know it's a weird one, isn't it? You know, no one really knows what went on with that, apart from him bringing this lawsuit. And we don't know whether there'll ever be any reconciliation in future. So I guess we just have to wait, really.
Yeah, it's a funny one, that, isn't it? Because, I mean, when he left, everyone sort of went, oh, he's left, and it's obviously acrimonious. And I think we all thought, oh, well, who's going to wank the nose in Slipknot? We always like the nose wank, didn't you? I always like that. And then Tortilla Man's come along, and he's taken that mantle, wasn't he? I mean, he hasn't got a big enough nose to do the nose wank, but he certainly jumps around a lot, and he's become like a really cool presence in the Slipknot live show. So I feel like poor old Chris Fenn is sort of, and his, you know, his painful nose wank move has been sort of resigned to the dustbin of history in Slipknot now.
I would have loved to have seen the position available advert for taking that role.
Must have good technique. Yeah, it was funny about Tortilla Man. We did a split Slipknot cover. Obviously, some of you might remember that. And we did. Did you write that, Steve?
I did.
We did a split cover run with all the different members. And Tortilla Man was way more popular than we thought, given he'd just come out at the time. And loads of people wanted to buy a Tortilla Man cover. So it's funny what can happen, what can become, you know, an unlikely success in this world.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Because Corey's mask just like. It's not great, his new mask, is it? The sort of recent Corey mask.
Slightly flappy mask.
Yeah, not the best, I don't think. So, I mean, I'd probably rather have the
tortilla for a face.
Well, I like Mick. Mick's the best one. He's just never changed his mask in the whole time they've been.
And he's terrifying.
He really is. Yeah.
AC/DC have released a taster for new single Demon Fire, which is super metal. That's the follow-up to their single Shot in the Dark. And they've released this trailer for it, and it's 53 seconds. What do you think of it? Have you heard it?
It's out next week. The whole album's out next week, isn't it?
Yeah, it's out on November 13th.
Right. The album. Have you heard the album?
No. Have you?
No. I might have done. I don't know if I'm allowed, you said no. I don't know if I'm allowed to say if I have or not.
You may have heard it.
I might have heard the whole thing.
Do you think it might sound like other AC/DC albums?
Whether I have or haven't actually heard it, and whether you have or haven't actually heard it, I think what it's going to sound like, you could put a fairly comfortable bet on what it's going to sound like. AC/DC sort of sound like AC/DC, don't they? And there's nothing wrong with that.
That's what I know. I now know two people who don't like AC/DC, and I just can't get my head around that. There's a lot of stuff, you know, people's opinions that I've been having difficulty getting my head around lately. But that's definitely one of them. And it's, like I said, it's just like hitting your own heartbeat. I don't understand it.
Well, we all have to come together in these dark times and try and settle our differences. Maybe you just have to play them some more music.
Yeah, but if AC/DC doesn't get you going, I don't know what, to be honest.
We also have new music coming up for December. We've got Deftones' White Pony remix album, Black Stallion, which is finally coming, and they've been talking about this since releasing White Pony, so like 20, how many years is it since White Pony, 25?
20 years.
20 years. I wrote the cover feature, but I've got a bad memory. Yeah, 20 years. So you finally got a Black Stallion coming, which some of us may or may not have heard, but we couldn't possibly say. But it's got remixes from Robert Smith, Mike Shinoda, DJ Shadow, and Square Pusher, and more. And when I saw Robert Smith and Mike Shinoda on the list, I was so excited. I think for other people, it will be different names. And I think that's the thing, actually, probably. It's such a good spread of names that you could look at that. Most people would probably be excited to hear at least one, if not more, of those songs.
Well, it's a DJ Shadow remix of Digital Bath, which, again, cannot confirm nor deny whether I've heard this record yet, but DJ Shadow remixing Digital Bath sounds like something that has been dreamed up in my head. That sounds like a lovely dream to me, and it actually being reality is nice.
That's exactly what I thought about Robert Smith. I thought, what a lovely dream that will become reality for me.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think, yeah, we'll see what that sounds like in December. But the fact that there's such a spread of people on there doing their own take on such a fantastic album can only mean good things, I think. Mm-hmm. It's album of the week time.
Yeah.
Good.
I really wanted a reaction, but Steve is an empathy vacuum and Jonathan is tired. So no reaction. Our album of the week is Solstice Fair, Endless Twilight of Codependent Love. I'll have to say that again. Endless Twilight of Codependent Love. I mean, that is the album title.
Like Michael Kaufman movie. It sounds like a Daniel Kaufman movie title.
Yeah, it does. Well, it's the follow-up to Birdreamin, which was their 2017 record. And it is their seventh album. So, Wow. I mean, Jonathan, I think you have many, many thoughts and feelings on this. Do you want to kick us off?
I do. Yeah. I just. So my first experience of Solstice Fair, again, was seeing them live. I had no idea who they were. They were playing at the much missed Purple Turtle in Camden. They're supporting Secrets of the Moon. This band come on with all this kind of cowboy gear and flower. And as a long-time Phil's Nephilim fan, I'm like, I know where that's coming from. And this is a black metal crowd, and they launch into stuff from the Cold album. And this is just this kind of like long whoosh to their sound, like a build-up and a whoosh. And two-thirds of the audience were like, had their jaws on the ground, because I don't think anyone had heard them at that point. Mm. And two-thirds were like, this isn't metal, but it is kind of. Or comes out of there.
So they had flour on them and looked like cowboys, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's in a very Fields of Nephilim way.
Yes.
And there's like one song which has this total Fields of Nephilim bass line. And I was just absolutely in love with this band from that point onwards. I just never heard anything like it. And yes, so the seventh album, so they've, you know, I've been aware of them for the last kind of four or five albums. And yeah, they, you know, the mood shift, but the mood shift between songs anyway. Each seems to have its own ecosystem, but each one is an album that only Solstice Fair could make. And yeah, this one, it's really, I mean, they're all kind of emotionally moving, but this one, it really gets to you. But it's like what you were saying about Code Orange, really. It's like, you know, there's loads of things that are homage, but this is why they're so innovative. Is that being innovative isn't just like bolting on some kind of dance beat to metal or something like that. It's translating it into, you know, your own experience. And it's like having your own commentary on what's gone before and create something completely new out of it that's really tied into the personalities. And also, you know, the fact they come from Iceland and the landscape around them that affects it. So, in the past, I've had kind of really gothy elements. The first track on this album, Akeri, no idea how to pronounce it. But, you know, towards the end, it goes through so many different kinds of...
They sing in Icelandic, we should say, shouldn't we, for anyone who's not familiar with it?
Yeah, for the most part. There's one song in English where it's just like, these lovely, languid, Thin Lizzy riffs towards the end, but each song. Now, thing about about Thin Lizzy, and it's the thing with like a lot of the classic bands like Maiden, whatever. And I think I've said this again on the podcast before, but what they do isn't rocket science, but no one else can do it. Like there's bands like there's bands that kind of really just specifically homages to Thin Lizzy, and it's like, yeah, you've got everything right, but you can't do that thing that Thin Lizzy do, which for me just makes me feel like everything is all right with the world, which I really need right now, by the way. But in the context of that song, they've totally nailed the vibe, because it's part of something else as well too. It's organic. It's like it's been organically transplanted, and it's taken root, and it's, and every song is like its own kind of emotional barometer. So they start off one way, they kind of reach their own crescendos, but you know, at their own sweet time, because most songs are around 10 minutes long. And so there's lots of different elements in this new album as well. You know, they say they've got like elements of the black metal past, but you know, for the first album wasn't really straightforward black metal anyway. It was kind of more punked up, kind of with black metal elements, but it's much rougher. They've got like weird like lounge jazz elements in there that all just seem to fit into their vibe, and there's such a sensitivity to the way they play, and it's so expansive. And you know, there's not many, I mean, there are bands that sing in their own native tongue, but there's not that many bands that can have you sort of almost on the verge of tears in a language you don't understand.
They are really emotional in that way. The way they do it is so nuanced. And I really agree with what you're saying about the diversity of styles. And when I was listening to this record, I was talking to you at the same time on Messenger, and you said, wait until you get to the smoky jazz lounge song. And I was just like, what? What are you talking about? And it is really cool when you get there and you just think, wow, they can do this as well.
Yeah, Ulfa, I think is that the or is it the smoky jazz song?
Well, you're the one who needs to pronounce all the names, so I'll just leave it to you.
Yeah, Icelandic is the hardest language in the world to pronounce.
Steve, what was your take on it?
I really like it. I mean, I wasn't there at the beginning like Jonathan was at Purple Turtle. In fact, I have to thank Jonathan for sending me to review them when I didn't really know anything about them in 2015. It was after Otter, which was their 2014 album, came out, and I'd seen a lot of chat about how great it was, and I think it did pretty well in the Hammer end of year list that year, but it was just for whatever reason something that I didn't get around to listening to. And then Jonathan, you were like, do you want to go and review this band? I know it's not necessarily the sort of thing that you would normally listen to, and I was like, oh yeah, well, you know, I will. And I listened to Otter in the build up to that, and I was just like, and then seeing it live as well, I think they played it in full then, and then even more so. And again, Jonathan, you sent me to Iceland to the festival Einstaflug. Yeah, and which
explain is Icelandic for flying bollocks,
right?
Because it's set on a lake in a town called Neskupstader, and people have a habit of just like jumping themselves in the lake naked. That's why it's called Flying Bollocks Festival.
It's a really like unbelievable, beautiful, like a really incredible experience to see those bands in that setting, and particularly to see them in that setting. I think like all the things you said about it not being rocket science what they do, I think one of the things that lots of modern bands, whether they be metal bands or whatever, I think a very, very clear sense of their own unique identity is an incredibly, it appears to be, because we don't see it as much as I would like, is a very, very difficult thing to pull off. And although you can pick kind of, you know, Icelandic folk music and more kind of ethereal gothic influences, and then obviously yes, the influence of Thin Lizzy being a massive one, but also, I mean, the last riff on the final song, which is Ulfa, I think is how you pronounce it, has got kind of COC, Corrosion Conformity vibes all over it, but in this prism of this really, like you say, very delicate, very beautiful ethereal soundscape. And those aren't things that are unique to music or popular music, but they are unique to be able to meld them together, to be able to kind of congeal those things together to make them into a sort of a cohesive idea, a cohesive unit, a sound that Like, I don't think I know any other bands that have even really attempted to kind of meld those three things. And it doesn't feel like they've sat down and gone, oh, we all like Thin Lizzy, but we're from Iceland, so let's sing in our, let's do Thin Lizzy songs that sing in Icelandic. Everything they do to me feels incredibly organic. Like, yeah. It really feel like it's been thought about. This album just sort of, it drifts out the speak. I mean, even when it's being heavy, it's kind of effortlessly heavy. There's a real kind of effortless, unspoken sort of connection between these musicians, and the sort of, when you mix it all together, the pie you get, they're just very, very unique. And I mean, they might not sound it from what we're saying, oh, you know, kind of black metal, gothic stuff, you know, folk metal and Thin Lizzy riffs. That might not necessarily sound like the most unique thing, but I genuinely don't think I can think of many bands who sound anything like this. And that's a massive
thing. Well, yeah, I mean, the word prism, I think, is really key. You know, it's like something that takes a single source of light and then just splits into this kaleidoscope.
Mm.
And that's really what they, you know, and that's really what they do. And there's a sense of like having drifted beyond the horizon and you don't really know the way back. And it's such like a personally resonant, feeling. And but it's also a communal feeling. And I've seen them a few times in Iceland and Icenaflug. And remember they were doing a series of three gigs and they did an Otter show. They did the rarity show and they did like a normal show, but seeing them play in their hometown, and it's been close to this at certain gigs in the UK as well too. But it was genuinely like I won't say this about many gigs, but it was genuinely one of those gigs that really felt like a spiritual experience, like you're out of your body, you know. And they've got this weird mix of like looking like total rock stars. I mean, every picture you do of the singer Addy. You know, it just, you're always going to catch him in a rock. You know, he's a kind of this tall, stick thin creature in a cowboy hat with an amazing beard, and just like they look like rock and roll stars. But there's a real kind of vulnerability to them at the same time, which seems wouldn't normally go hand in hand. But the way they do that, it's just, you know, and it's all like, you know, from deeply personal experience. You know, a lot of times when they play live, they talk about sort of mental health issues on stage, and so it's really stuff that's kind of in their blood. And you know, the Thin Lizzy aspects and the metal elements, you know, when they're so in your blood, you don't have to be self-consciously referencing them; they'll just come out, and it's just part of what your vision is anyway. And you know, they've been together for like 20 years. And it's developed over time, and this record feels like really very much the kind of culmination of it. And it's diverse, but it's still like, you know, it's its own unique thing. But each song has it, like I said, has its own internal weather system. Like, it just feels the way they develop and they kind of reach crescendo, and it's not your typical quiet, loud dynamic that lots of post rock bands do. It's just, it's the dynamics are just much more fluid, and they take your breath away every time.
I always picture them wearing cowboy hats and standing in the snow, and I know they've got pictures of them doing that, but I also think, is that the music just planting that in my mind?
yeah, but that's what their pictures often look like, and also that's just the nature. But also, you know, if you go to Iceland, you know, the landscape itself is consciousness altering, the scale of it. And they might not be aware of it being notes themselves, but there is that element of that almost like consciousness altering and appealing to elements that are kind of beyond your, you know, beyond your mental kin, and just filling the gap between the end of you and the, you know, and what you're kind of appealing to that I find is just really, just it resonates, it really strikes a really deeply human personal chord, as much you know, there's elements of landscape bound in with you know, kind of personal testimony as well. And it's got quite a unique voice as well, Addy. It's kind of really nice, really good raspy voice. That's not technically brilliant, but it really gets something across.
Well, go listen to that. It's out on Friday. That is Solstafir, Endless Twilight of Codependent Love. And as our reviews editor, Jonathan, what else is coming out this Friday that people should be aware of? What are your picks?
Well, my main pick for this Friday, and it's something actually I think I gave Steve to review, which is Shackles.
Oh, yeah.
Australian band called, some kind of a mini album called Hatred's Reservoir. It's just like being, it's kind of hardcore punk, it's just in a very Australian way, belligerent, no fucks given way, just being driven backwards and then reversed over again and then back forwards again. So it's kind of like there's a genre of metal from Australia called war metal, which is basically bands like Destroyer 666, which is just this kind of black thrash but just absolutely just rampaging it all over you, and this is like a kind of a more hardcore version of that. So my other big one is Gamana, Four Bundit, which is like a sort of a in the same vein as like Vodruna and Heilung, but a bit more, they use a bit more electronics, and their album's called Four Bundit, and they've been going for 25 years, I think, and it's a really interesting mix of just like, sort of Nordic folk and modern electronica, but with this kind of dark underbelly to it. Again, with an incredible female singer. All the other stuff I haven't really spent a lot of time with.
Well, stuff out this Friday anyway. So go and get into it. Garmana, we should probably spell, is Garmana. That's quite a hard one to spell. And Shackles was the other one. Hopefully you can spell that. And I also want to give a shout out to Ventenna and their album Hollow Storm, which are...
Yeah, that was really good. I heard of it.
I just want to back you up on that Shackles record, by the way, Jonathan, which is fucking excellent. Absolutely fucking excellent. Like, proper... It's like the middle ground between kind of blackened death metal and power violence. And it is... Yeah. It's a really, really horrible sounding record. I love it when bands are just, you know, kind of ruthlessly nihilistically oppressive. And that record is as loud and horrible as pretty much anything that you'll hear this year. It's really, really fucking good.
Yeah, it's a bit like really stubborn gristle in a food processor.
Yeah.
Just the right thing for your empathy vacuum, Steve. And that last one I mentioned was Ventenna Hollow Storm. They're a British band who do kind of industrial / rock stuff, and they're really cool too. So check them out. Shall we do some reader questions?
Yep. Go on in.
Go on then. Shall I read the first one?
Yeah, why not?
Why not, hey? It's from David Inglis, and he asks, following Trivium's deep cut stream, do you think there is a market for deep cut tours? What acts would you personally like to see on such a tour? Deep cuts, guys. Who do you want to see?
Ooh. Well, I tell you what, for the Metal Hammer website, the worst to best of Mastodon albums. So I spent the last couple of days doing the entire Mastodon back catalogue. And I was like, there's so many songs. Having seen Mastodon on pretty much every single tour they've done since the Leviathan era, there still feels like a lot of stuff that I've either never seen them play or I haven't seen them play for a very, very long time. So I would absolutely love to see a Mastodon deep cut set, particularly full of Remission era stuff, which they sort of, you know, they do March of the Fire Ants and they do Mother Puncher a fair bit from Remission, but they don't really do much else from that album. So I would definitely like to hear that. I mean, stuff like Where Strides a Behemoth. Ooh, yeah. So Mastodon would be, you ask me this very second, Mastodon would be up there, right up there.
I agree with you, actually. Having just done a massive feature on Mastodon and their Rarities record, that's actually in the current issue, out now, Judas Priest on the cover. I listened to the whole Rarities record and got really into all of those songs and chatted to them about the stories behind them and what they remember of recording them and what they mean to them. And you forget how many records Mastodon have had, and you forget how intricate and complex some of the songs are. And they've just had an amazing career, so I would totally back you on that. Medium Rarities, that's the name of their record, because obviously it's a hilarious pun.
It is, yeah.
Jonathan?
I don't know. I mean, I was thinking, like, you know, the most pointless one would be AC/DC.
Bedlam in Belgium. They never play that anymore, do they? Get that on.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I've seen, like, Enslaved did a really great rarity set. You know, they've got, like, you know, there's a lot of amazing stuff in their back catalogue. I'm looking forward to hearing Orange Goblin play all the old sort of more trippy psychedelic stuff. That's going to be amazing.
That's cool.
I'd like to see Watain do a lot of songs that aren't normally on their live sets, especially, you know, kind of from the early days. Other than that, I can't, honestly, I've had very little time to actually think about this one, so I'm just going to just put that out there. So, you know, a lot of the bands I really like, you know, Amon Ra or something, but they're kind of all on the same kind of vein.
Deep Cuts is quite a cool thing to have, because people often do buy request shows, but often the requests are the hits. So it's kind of nice if you have something that's like either Deep Cuts or like buy request Deep Cuts, because it's specifically going to be like the weirder stuff then, the lesser played stuff.
Well, Metallica Deep Cuts would be great, right? Because I mean, I think like a lot of us listening, or certainly on this podcast, definitely would have seen Metallica a lot.
And we've seen By Request as well, which is not Deep Cuts, it's By Request.
Yeah, and By Request, I mean, that's what kind of made me think that, because people were still voting for fucking Enter Sandman.
Yeah.
It's like, well, they're going to play that anyway, aren't they? So you might as well vote for something else. They're always going to play Sad But True. They're always going to play Nothing Else Matters. Like, you might as well vote for something else, and people didn't. But to say, to go and see Metallica knowing that they like weren't going to play any of their big songs, and they were going to dive right back into like the, you know, the unheard gems from that sort of first run of 5-6 records, would be amazing, I think.
Cool. Steve, do you want to do the next question?
Yeah, why not? Why bloody not? This is a question from Joe Longstaff. It says, Has there ever been a band who you've loved musically, but you've had a problem with how they act personally with fans or other musicians?
I've got to say, before anyone answers this, don't say anything that's going to make me have to edit this podcast. Be very careful what you say.
Danzig?
Right.
He comes across like... just a bit of a goon, just a bit of a like sort of... You know, I mean, I saw when he played Download in 2011, I want to say, and he just kept swearing at the sound monitor guy, and he chucked a sound monitor over at the sound guy, and he just spent most of the gig like swearing at him and stuff. And I was a bit like, you're paying more attention to this sound guy than you are to the crowd. So come on, mate. And everyone's sort of seen videos of Danzig, you know, acting up, if you like. So, you know, playing up and being a bit. You know, we've all heard those stories about Danzig, or seen him being punched in the face by someone for whatever reason. And he just comes across as just a sort of grumpy little man, really. But I love his music. I think it's all right to be a grumpy little man. It's not the end of the world. But, you know, yeah, Danzig.
Yeah, also, everyone loves the picture of him going out to get cat food as well. I mean, where would we be without that?
Yeah, nowhere. Society would crumble.
Yeah, I mean, I have a record that's so not metal at all, but I absolutely love. And I've totally forgotten it now because I'm tired. Well, we can cut this bit out. But I tell you who, like, I really like Nails, but they have a habit of getting into spats.
Oh yeah, yeah.
They're pretty. They don't come across as like the nicest guys in the world, but sometimes I've got to say, especially in the metal world, sometimes assholes make great music. Sometimes it's not in spite of them being assholes. It's sometimes like there's gigs, especially like a black metal gig, and that, you know, when there's a genuine friction in the air, it's really exciting. And I think this is one thing that I think we've kind of lost a little bit, is that real genuine sense of confrontation that just really puts all your hairs on end. But you know, sometimes it's like, I've been to a few gigs where it's kind of felt genuinely dangerous and you don't know what's going to happen next. And I kind of miss that a little bit, to be honest. It's just not in our lexicon anymore.
It's kind of that old question, isn't it? Has rock got too safe or has metal got too safe? Well, I've picked one that's not very Metal Hammer, but it's Jared Leto, because he literally has a 30 Seconds to Mars camp where people have to dress in
water
and worship him. It's called
Camp. But you like the music?
I used to think it was all right, like not setting the world on fire, but like decent kind of radio rock that you'd go, yeah, it's kind of all right. But what's that?
Fucking hell, his music makes me want to set the world on fire. I can't believe it. Like, I think Jared Leto comes across as an absolute prick in everything to do with 30 Seconds to Mars, but I'd still prefer him being a prick than listening to his records, to be honest, which
I kind of thought they were okay, but, you know, when he was kind of at his peak, I was working at Kerrang! Magazine, so we did used to do quite a lot with him, and I thought, you know, it's well-produced, he's got a lot of, like, again, like, money and resource behind him, he knows what he's doing, you can't, even if you don't love it, you can't, like, particularly say it's shit or anything. You know, it's decent for what he was doing. But I kind of admire and also think it's terrible that you can have a camp where you just get people to dress in white and worship you. I mean, I guess on the one end of it, fair play. And on the other end of it, really?
Yeah.
I'm only on one end of that. I'm just purely on the really end of that.
Yeah. I think it's a weird thing. I mean, it sort of goes back to what we were talking about last week with political musicians and political ideas and stuff, and should people say this and that and the other. I think if you're getting you think you're going to get some sort of moral backbone from the music industry, I think you're grossly overestimating the sort of people who were making music in the first place. You should probably just try and enjoy their music, and if you can find someone that you like, then consider that a bonus. I mean, just today people have been ranting on about Johnny Rotten, John Lydon. I mean, I don't really know. Like, are you? Or you're really surprised? Like, what's the fucking thing to moan about? Oh, the bloke who is in a band with that junkie murderer is wearing a hat that you don't like. Fucking hell! Like,
there's always going to be controversy. That's just a thing. That's life.
Like one of my favorite and most. You know, and you can hear actually elements of this in Soulstifer, actually, just in terms of spirit. But one of my favorite, like, very non-metal records is Astral Weeks by Van Morrison. It's got that really autumnal feel. And he's like the grumpiest bastard in the world. And it's just like, you can't put the character to the music at all. But sometimes, you know, art creates strange alchemies and things you wouldn't expect.
I'm just going to say no one can be as grumpy as Steve. Do you want to do that question, Jonathan? Question number three?
Yeah. So what are some, this is from Andy Poole. What are some great heavy, lyrically or sonically non-metal albums? The Holy Bible by The Manics would be his pick. Lyrically and sonically, it's a bleak, uncompromising and unrelenting album, which would be alien to anyone who knows their post.
Everything Must Go and This Is My Truth, Tell Me Yours output.
Yeah. Well,
that was the correct answer.
Well, somebody put this on Facebook hoping that you would answer it, Steve. They actually just wanted you to answer this question because they know that you love the Manics.
I do, and that is I would say that is probably the correct answer. There's loads. I mean, if I'm not allowed to pick the Holy Bible, which I think I probably shouldn't. I mean, if people are like, Manic Street Preachers, really? And you haven't heard that kind of early stuff. I mean, yeah, I think the Holy Bible is as bleak as anything that's ever happened in music. I mean, the first line on the first song talks about cutting a baby's cock off, and that was a single as well. I mean, it is unbelievably bleak, that record. And if you are thinking it's going to be If You Tolerate This and, you know, Designed for Life, like, you really need to check that record out. But I have done other three, they said, oh, you could probably be a 3-hour long podcast talking about that album. I've done 2 hours and 50 talking about that album before, so you can go and find that somewhere else if you like. And but for other ones, I mean, Skeleton Tree by Nick Cave is, I've been listening to a lot recently. That is hard work.
It's the one after the death of his son.
Yeah.
So he'd recorded the music before, he'd written the songs beforehand, but he recorded them afterwards. And I just remember, like, you know, when everyone got that record, when it came out on Spotify or whatever, when you first got it and you're waiting to play it, everyone was just going, taking deep breaths, like, I can do this, I can do this, I can do this, and just like going into it. And it, oh God, it's, I mean, it's bleak, but it's beautiful. And you know, there's some kind of work into it. It's not it's not kind of bleak by the end of it. It's stark, but it's allowing something to grow within it. And so I wouldn't call that bleak in the same way that Holy Bible is bleak.
No, absolutely not. No, not at all. It's just very challenging, difficult to listen to.
This might be unexpected, but actually the Manic Street Preachers were a really, really important band for me, like on a really personal level. So, I knew Richie and Richie Manic and Nicky pretty well, actually. I reviewed them live for my old magazine, Major Maker, around Time of Gold Against the Soul, or before that. Ended up talking all night with Nicky while in the hotel about our completely opposing ideas of you know, music and communication, but we kind of met totally in the middle, and that conversation really made me rethink my whole approach to life and writing. And I got much better for it. I became really obsessed with the Manics after that. You know, really into the Manics anyway. And I interviewed Nicky and Richie around the time of God Against the Soul. Did a major big piece for another magazine called Lime Lizard, which weirdly I brought in ideas of Queer Theory, but that's a whole other story. They just seemed to fit what they were doing, and you know, everyone totally got the wrong end. You know, a lot of people so totally got the wrong end of the stick about the Manics, about, you know, just this very reductive idea of what working class means. And and they were like so well read, and you know, they were just such a fascinating, intelligent band. For me, the bleakest record other than that, and I probably got talked about this a lot, is Holy Money by Swans. Like nothing I'd ever heard before. Just so devoid of hope, like just melody, just this abject grind. And that was another record that changed my life and just absolutely like horrified me and chilled me to the core when I first heard it. And that did actually become a lifelong obsession, that band, after that. But that's not just the bleakest, but physically the heaviest band. That's probably the heaviest record you'll ever hear. And it's not a metal record. There's industrial and no wave in there, but it's not a record metal, but it's heavier than like pretty much any metal record you'll ever hear.
I think that the idea that metal is the heaviest quote unquote type of music, I don't think it is. I mean, you mentioned no wave and industrial and you get kind of avant-garde. I mean, there's an album, again, something, if you want to listen to something which is sonically punishing, rather than kind of lyrically bleak or whatever, there's an album that came out from an American beat poet rapper called More Mother that came out a couple of weeks ago. I can't remember the name of the album off the top of my head, but I mean, I listened to that and it was just, you know, that kind of ambient avant-garde jazz thing. It can be so sonically punishing, far more sonically punishing than, you know, a deathcore band doing loads of sub drops or whatever. I mean, I think something like The Drift by Scott Walker.
Yeah.
Such a like head fuck. And you get this kind of like, you know, experimental electronic artists who can make noises which will just decimate your hearing. And, you know, and a lot of kind of horrorcore and hip hop. And even like the first Plan B album, there's a song called Sick to Death on the first Plan B album. Now I know Plan B, like, a lot of people were going, what, the guy who's on the Brits and he was that Zoot Suit, you know, the Defamation of Strickland Banks, and he became a pop star, that kind of like Zoot Suity Amy Winehouse soul musician for a while. But that first album is really confrontational. And there's a song called Sick to Death on it, which is as horrible lyrically, like one of the most sort of repulsive feelings that you get from him. And it's all about censorship, and it's all about like the power of an artist to be able to say the things that they want to say on a record. And he deliberately goes out of his way to be really controversial. And it's really, really, really striking. And like Caligula by Lingua Ignota, I know a bit like Swans is probably more in the metal world than
and Germanic Atlas as well.
Yeah, and yeah, and I think stuff like that is, you know, will always be heavier than just a thrash band.
Yeah, the other really, like, one of the heaviest live bands I've ever seen was a band called God back in the late 80s, early 90s. And they were like anything up to 10 people on stage, two drummers. The main guy, Kevin Martin, who's now actually really gone on to fame as The Bug, which is this huge, big kind of dance hall, you know, sort of dance producer. And he's, you know, he's kind of really famous. But I'd go and see their gigs, and literally, like, within 10 minutes, 80% of the audience would just flee. I remember, like, seeing him at an old venue in Angel called the Powerhouse, and there's really long steps down to the toilets. And I remember going out for rehab after about 10 minutes of just like, and it's like the, all these really deep long steps were just full of people taking refuge, and anyone inside, it just became Lord of the Flies. You know, the people left. I saw them at a festival in Holland called Tegentown, and some guy, it was so primal, so groovy, and this wild saxophone going through, and this guy came on stage and tried to throttle the singer. And I remember, like, we were chatting to Mark the next day, just like, what the fuck happened last night? It was just this weird, like, the gig beforehand just seemed like this weird fever dream. So they're probably hard to find on Spotify. They're called God, but there's lots of bands called God. He did a thing with it's also really heavy, the thing with project with Kevin Martin. Kevin Martin did a project with Justin Broderick from Godflesh called Techno Animal, and their last album, which sadly isn't on Spotify, it's kind of hip-hoppy, but the beats are so bass heavy that it actually can make you feel physically sick.
I hate music like that, Jonathan.
Yeah.
But, I hate feeling sick.
I would say that if you're looking for a really good God record, probably you can find it on YouTube, called The Anatomy of Addiction. And it's this real kind of body horror. There's a song called Body Horror, or the song's called On All Floors, On All Fours. They have a song called Fucked. So you can see where they're kind of coming from. Really smart, interesting guy, Kevin Martin. And he was at the center of, like, all the kind of industrial stuff in the late 80s, early 90s. He put on a club in Brixton, where it's the first time I saw Godflesh in 89, and it's the first time I saw Oxbow, another really fucked up band that's not necessarily metal, but just, like, you're watching them and, like, what the fuck. I'd go on YouTube if you can't find it anywhere else, and look for The Anatomy of Addiction. It will blow your mind to this day. And it came out, I can't remember what year it came out now, but 94, I think it came out, and it will blow your mind today.
Well, I picked Bowie's Black Star, and I know you guys like that as well.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'll ever really understand everything in that record, but it's very heavy emotionally, and obviously he passed away 2 days after it was released.
That and Skeleton came out within about 6 months of each other. I think they're two of the, like, for major artists, those are two of the most just very, very difficult, challenging, weighty records that you will hear from a superstar artist.
Like genuine art.
We have a question from Tom Farrow. He says, as it's been discussed several times, deadlines for album of the year being around now, why does the magazine not do the album of the year stuff after Christmas, so the list submitted can include all the albums from the year? Good question from Tom.
Yeah, why am I having the pick in October? Come on, why?
Well, it's Jonathan, you're a news editor, so I'll throw it to you.
Yeah, it's. I mean, you know, so I used to work for a weekly, and obviously you could do it much quicker, but you want the end albums of the year to come out, you know, that year. It becomes too retrospective if you do it in the new year. In the new year, you're spending a lot of time talking about what's coming up in the new year.
Totally.
So, and I want to say this as well to everyone who ever sends in records, like, we work really far ahead. So, I need album promos 2 months in advance of their release date. And so it takes a while to get everyone's, you know, for people to actually think about what their votes are, because we need to run it in the December issue. It just so happens that, you know, our December issue comes out on December 10th, which is quite early in the month. So it's literally just the logistics of putting together a monthly magazine that you have to work ahead. And in the same way that, you know, people email me and say, can you review our album? We've just put it out. And just like, think about this logically. You know, how long does it take? You know, I've got to send it out for review. I've got to, someone's got to write it. I've got to sub it. We've got to lay it out. This takes 2 months. So it does really suck that there may be a few albums towards the end of the year that we can't always get, or that might have done better. I think Solstafear might have done better in our albums of the year, not giving too much away. Would have done even better if it had come out a bit earlier.
I agree with you though. It's like, it's just the way we have to do it, because otherwise it'd be January and the moment's passed. And also, personally, I really like to just sit around and listen to them all over Christmas. We're lucky enough to get sometimes like a week to 10 days off at Christmas when the office closes. And obviously there's probably no office closing this year. Our houses can close, our desks can close. But then you can just sit around and just sit down with the top 50 and listen to them all and just absorb them all. And that's a really nice thing to do, I think, at the end of the year.
Yeah, I discovered so much music like as a kid reading other magazines' top 50s, but I also think that our top 50s every year they're a really good cross section of what's gone on in the year. This year's will be very much so as well. You know, there's a lot of things people wouldn't expect, and that's the thing. It's just like, it's like the top 50s are really important. I think it's one of the most important things we do. How we write the blurbs, and you know, there's a lot of things. You know, I think a lot of people, and I used to do this. I'd read a review in a top 50 thing. I go out and buy it, and I discovered that's how I discovered TalkTalk.
Well, top 50 will be out on December the 10th, as Jonathan mentioned. So put that in your diary/calendar/ wherever you write your dates. Maybe you write them on the wall in blood. I don't know. Why not do that? Pick it up.
It's like all the best things in the world. It's like, it's not necessarily predictable. You couldn't necessarily predict everything, but once it's there, it makes complete sense.
Well, Jonathan, oh, it's the same name as you. Jonathan Scott Anderson asks, where does the podcast crew stand on GWAR?
As far away from the scuttlefish as possible.
As far away from the fake blood as possible.
Well, that was the late Odus Orangus's prosthetic, humongous prosthetic penis.
I do.
That was shit. Audiences, and I saw them back then, and
I remember that.
Yeah,
refer to it in all the interviews as well.
Yeah. So I remember seeing them back then, and this would have been in the 90s, and I thought for the first 15 minutes this is the greatest thing in the world. And then in the next year, you kind of just got used to it. But their audience was the most scuzziest audience I've ever seen. Just massive rank cider crusties. Just
I am surprised.
Yeah. But I think, you know, they're such smart people, and I love, you know, and you know, they didn't give a fuck about outrage. But they were also trying to make a point. Like, when you see Spitting Image now, it's just like, you know, they're putting their punches a little bit because they're scared to offend too many people. And maybe you're not making the point you should make. And, you know, they're really great at being really offensive. But, you know, to be offensive, you have to be actually offended. And they're making some really important points, but just done in a kind of grotesque space aliens from space scatological way. I think, you know, I wouldn't necessarily listen to the records, but I remember that kind of movie they made, which is really good fun, and you know, massive gross out in the way that early that, you know, like that Bad Taste movie was early.
Everyone used to love that movie with the explosions and things.
Yeah, and then he went on to produce Lord of the Rings.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that. Steve.
Yeah, so,
I've not really given them that much attention, to be honest, in my lifetime, to be honest. They're a bit of a blind spot for me. I know I've seen them live. I think I saw them at Download in 2011, 10 or 11. 11, I think. And I thought it was really interesting. And it's a great show. I've also seen Empire Records again recently, and they're in that. and one of the characters in Empire Records gets eaten on stage by Guar. I think that would have been the first time that I ever saw them. I remember being like, what the fuck is this? I don't really have a strong opinion on Guar either way, to be honest. I'm kind of glad they exist, if they do still exist. I'm not sure if they do. Are they still?
They've got a release coming out, but obviously, you know, the guy Odorous passed away, and so I've forgotten the name of the woman who fronts them now,
right?
Or the she creature that fronts them now. I've forgotten.
Yeah.
But my mother, so I've interviewed him as Odorous and in his actual guise, and you know, very different people. But my other favorite Odorous moment was in my old magazine. We used to have a feature called Barbarian Wrath, where we take someone to the crowbar and ask them completely random questions and get them to rant about stuff. That was absolutely, you know, just totally random. But we did that with Guar in makeup. So we had a picture of Guar walking down Oxford Street or Charing Cross Road from behind with his arse sticking out of his trousers.
Just what everyone wants to see when they're going to do their shopping on the main street in London. Just what everyone wants.
Yeah. Coming out of Starbucks and seeing Odorous's arse.
Who wants to take the very last question?
I will. Ben Wilmot says, if you were appointed the god of rock and metal for one day, don't know who the current god is, but what is the one thing that you would change? I would personally ban drum solos. Oh, yeah. Oh, when anyone caught using a backing track, the audience is allowed to throw tomatoes at them. Not so fussed with the backing track thing. We spoke about Fever 333 last week. And
yeah, they have a backing track.
A lot of backing track. And whilst I would never say that you should use that, I don't really mind that much if people use a little bit of track. The drum solo thing. Yeah, been that.
It depends who it is, 100%, though. I think there are some.
Yeah, I think I'm fairly maligned. Kojira do drum solos, and that's amazing.
Exactly. I was going to say that massive one that Mario did when they, at the beginning of lockdown, when everyone was doing the streams, and Kojira did their gig from Red Rocks, and Mario did a drum solo, and it was just like, this is insane, this is inhuman, and it's in the most amazing setting. It just looks amazing. Like, I really enjoyed that. But if it's just some drummer who's kind of from a band that you don't really care about, no.
Maybe you should have to get your drum solo license. So Mario, yeah. Danny Carey, Brand Daler, they can all have their drum solo license.
Mayhem have a drum solo, and that's amazing. I think when people think of drum solos, they probably think of some you know, prog bod just pissing about on drums on about 50 different drums, but they can still be like really primal.
I always got to see Dream Theater with two other bands. I can't remember who it was now. I was quite excited at the time. And they did a drum solo where it's the three drummers from all the prog bands together on stage on three kits. And that was kind of cool. But if you hate those bands, you would have been like, fuck this.
Yeah.
With all fucking Steel Panther doing a drum solo, it's like, no.
I don't know, that belongs with the era to an extent, doesn't it?
Yeah, but no one wants, you know, like if you go and see that, I mean, that sort of thing, you don't want a drum solo. Like, I saw Bon Jovi once, and all of them got a solo. I'm not here to watch you do a solo.
They probably thought you were a diehard fan, Steve.
So I tell you what I would change, like, for a day or two with drums. And I don't mind them occasionally, but I'd get rid of triggers.
Oh, okay.
Like double bass triggers. I've been to festivals where, like, you know, extreme metal festivals where everyone is doing, like, every single band on the main stage had triggers. So it's just, you know what triggers do? They just basically, whatever you do, it'll give the same kind of beat, but it has this really mechanic, inorganic sound. And it just can take, like, in the case of Behemoth, it works kind of well because they've got this very militaristic sound. But you hear too much of it, and it's just the same, you know, and it's really flat, kind of slightly flat metallic set, flat automatic.
I know what you mean.
I get too much of it, and so I went to this festival, and then I went downstairs to the second venue, and then Armored Threat were playing, and they play faster than pretty much anyone else. and no triggers. I was just, oh my God, an organic drum sound. So, yeah, I'd also, anyone who does clean, like, also I'd stop everyone doing, like, for like a month, like, stop doing clean, growly vocals in a metalcore way. Just like, you know,
I'd stop that for a month.
Yeah, at least. So people have to think about how not, you know, not to, because if you met someone like that, who's just like, whoa, I'm really angry about this, and then they start whining, that's the most passive-aggressive person. You'd run a fucking mile from that person. That's like, that's literally the definition of toxic male personality. Of just like being really angry and whining.
I don't think for that reason.
They do it almost like a checklist, but it's literally the definition of toxic male personality. And so I'd get rid of that.
I don't think they do it for that reason. I think they do it to convey different emotions and almost as an instrument at different parts of the song that require clean or unclean vocals.
No, it's just become an absolute cliche that bands do without thinking about it. And you know they do think about it because when you interview these bands, they have nothing to say for themselves.
Controversial.
I would also like, what I'd actually like to get rid of is people referring to bands who've had 20 to 25 year old year long careers as kids bands. You're covering Megadeth. Oh, what is this, like Tweeny Hour or something? It's like one. What's, you know, aren't children allowed to like music? Is that a bad thing? Is it, if a young person likes something, it can't be very good? Fucking ridiculous. And two, when people were like, oh, you know, teeny bopper music like Slipknot. Slipknot have been around for 25 years.
Yeah.
Even if you got into Slipknot the day you were born, you could be
I've never talking about Slipknot. I've never heard anyone say that about Slipknot, but we don't really cover them, but there are a lot of kind of like bands that were sort of in the metal world that were basically trying to be boy bands.
Yeah.
They were going down that route.
And I mean, like in the early 2000s,
It's just like the end of Animal Farm, where the pigs become the things, you know, they were supposed to be against. So that's an observation. It's not my world. It's not something I'm super condemning. But I just find it something I find weird and can't get my head around. Right. Well, you know, all the kind of like R&B vocals and stuff.
Yeah, but that's
a little bit of genre mixing.
But if you're mixing something that is totally antithetical to what metal is about, you know, like I said, it's just that kind of Spotify generation of picking a bit of here and there, everything. And just like sticking in because what you've been listening to, which is the exact opposite of what we're talking about, what Soulstiffy do, when something's actually in your blood and it's been allowed to percolate there for a while.
I don't know why we keep talking over each other. This podcast, there's something in the air or the water or something. If I was God of Rock and Metal, I think I would want to improve accessibility a bit as well. I'd want to make it like, whether it's physical access to venues or providing sign language interpreters. I think there's some like bands or venues or festivals in the States that are a bit better than us at that, because you see people like the very famous in video of like Lamb of God being interpreted. There's a couple of those that are really cool and just kind of opening up gigs for people. And women's merch as well, I really want to change that, because the amount of time you just get stuck with the men's t-shirt and it's like, I don't want to wear a men's t-shirt, I want to wear a woman's t-shirt. That's really frustrating as well. I'd change that. I'd also like to have more snacks at gigs in case I get hungry. If I was the God of Rock and Metal, I'd be like, yeah, I've had a couple of drinks and now I want a piece of cake, so can I have that as well?
So you're saying on stage, like a sort of bakery, in a bar.
Yeah.
That'd be good.
A little bakery, and you could get like a cake or like a muffin.
I wouldn't trust their cakes.
What's that?
Certain venues, like, I don't trust the beer. I wouldn't trust their cakes.
Yeah, but you still drink from them, though, don't you? So
I don't. There's certain venues, I won't drink from the tap.
Really?
I'll get a bottle. I won't take anything on tap.
Well, then maybe they could have some cakes in packets, then, so you'd know where they came from. But you could have, you know, metal cakes. You could have little cake that says 666 on it, or you could have like, you know, some black ice cream or something. I realize this is just my fantasy, but I'm the god here, so I can do what I want.
I picked up your point about merch, by the way, Eleanor. I have to say, you might only be able to get the men's T-shirts, but they're such shit cuts of T-shirt. It doesn't matter what you are. You're going to look like a frumpy old... I'm talking about myself now as well, frumpy old piece of shit. Because they're awful. The T-shirts are fucking awful. So I would say, bands, stop using Fruit of the Loom and Gildian. Cheap shit. Do a good one. The reason I buy Metallica T-shirts from H&M and from Top Man is because the cut of the shirt is good. And I don't care. And then apparently I'm a poser because I don't want to look... or the T-shirt's too tight on me. Like, come on.
No one wants to feel strangled by the neck and have those really long arms that make you look like you're not even a human being.
No. And also, don't like, and the whole thing about buying T-shirts from shops and stuff is just like, let people wear it. If someone wants to wear a bloody Rolling Stones T-shirt and they don't know that they're even a band, who gives a shit? It's just a fucking T-shirt.
Yeah, I agree. Because maybe they'll listen to the band afterwards, or someone else will listen to the band. You never know.
I would have to say that, like, having cake at a stand-up venue that would be logistically a bit difficult.
You're just not thinking imaginatively enough.
No, but you're going to hold your paper plate up. You'll be trying to put full cake in your mouth, and someone's going to bump into you, and you're going to stab yourself with a fork.
We have a plastic spoon.
What kind of cake are you eating? I was thinking a chocolate brownie or a bit of bloody Rocky Road or something.
Look, I've been to gigs at the Union Chapel. We can get cake and ice, like I saw Vodruna at the Union Chapel, but that's a sit-down venue. And you get cake and ice cream and coffee. And as a change, that was pretty good. I don't know if I'd want cake at the Underworld.
Cake in a packet. Cake that's already been made in a packet.
Yeah, I don't know.
Right, that's what I'm saying. I'm the god of rock and metal, and we're having cake. And that's the end of the podcast. So, and again, if anyone wants to send any cake, we haven't got an office right now, so you can't, but maybe next year. Maybe next year you could send us some cake. We'd enjoy that. Thanks for listening, everyone. And we'll be back next week. And Merlin will be back next week from his adventures, probably in his house because it's a pandemic. And we'll have loads more exciting things to talk about. Goodbye, everybody.
See you later.
Goodbye.